Hello and welcome to Asia Matters, the podcast where we go in depth into the big stories happening in the world's most exciting region. I'm Andrew Peeple. Well, China's rulers have been setting out their plans at the country's big annual political meetings in Beijing, often referred to as the Lianghui. Observers have been watching closely for signs of where China is headed in the near term as the country continues its recovery from the global pandemic. But this year's event has even deeper significance, as policymakers have been finalizing their latest five-year plan for China's economy, as well as targets for the country's environment. Well, later in this episode, I'll speak to Scott Rozelle from Stanford University about the long-term challenge China faces from wealth inequality and the so-called middle income trap. But first, I'm joined by two experts to discuss the outcomes from the Lianghui and how they assess the current health of China's economy. Tao Wang is the Hong Kong-based chief China economist and head of Asia Economic Research at UBS. Hello to you, Tao.
Hello, Andrew.
And Ginny Yan is a managing director and chief China economist at ICBC Standard Bank in London. Hello, Ginny.
Hi, Andrew.
It's great to have you and thank you so much for your time, both of you. As we're recording, China's big political meetings have just wrapped up. What stood out from the meeting from both of you? And maybe Tao, if you could answer that first.
Sure. What stood out, I think China for this year set quite a modest growth target of just above 6% when everyone expect to be much higher. But at the same time, the policy tone is quite dovish. So that leaves the government ample flexibility and upside. There were no new wording on property as well. And the deficit reduction is a bit smaller than expected. On the long term, the government mentioned about necessary infrastructure, boost manufacturing, and also emphasize on technology and innovation. Both the short term and long term, they're very focused on employment and consumption. And the key way to support that, they see as supporting the market entity, which means companies, plus better social safety net and public service.
Ginny, they did set a growth target, as Tao said, of above 6%. And lots of people, as you said as well, are seeing that as relatively conservative, because obviously economies like China's are going to experience a natural bounce back this year, probably as a result of the comeback from the pandemic. So why do you think they have been relatively conservative about the growth target?
Well, first of all, I think having an explicit target of 6% itself was a little bit of a surprise to me, at least. And I think that suggests that this is very much a floor, a minimum, rather than an ambitious target. It is really balanced by a very ambitious five-year plan, as we know. But I think given that we have now an explicit target to work with, what also came out is the importance of moving away from that explicit GDP growth target to much more implicit targets such as job creation, household income growth, credits are being channeled to the real economy rather than to asset classes. So I think that is the key. It's really to focus on the quality and efficiency of how GDP growth is going to be produced in the coming years.
So it's part of a longer shift towards emphasizing quality, as you say, over quantity of growth.
Absolutely. And I think in every element of what we heard, whether it's on sustainability or whether it's about reducing wasteful investment and also to control debt, for example, all of that is really setting up the work towards how to make that GDP growth much more productive.
Tao, you said that policy this year has been set in a relatively dovish way. Even so, they are reducing the amount of fiscal stimulus, the amount that the government is putting into the economy this year, it seems, compared with last year. And at the same time, the Chinese central bank looks to be pumping less money into the economy this year. Is that the correct approach in your view?
The government I think, is shifting the focus a bit on policy, because even though they set up a relatively modest growth target, but the economy is recovering very strongly. And this year, we're going to see especially the consumption and corporate investment rebounding. So I think it's time for the authorities to reshift the focus a bit back to what they were doing before the pandemic and before trade war with the U.S. escalated in 2019 and 20. Towards control risk and control leverage, so for the longer term sustainability. So I think it is the right thing to do, and that seems to be what the government is planning to do, and that indeed is going to be done through a smaller budget deficit and with the central bank pumping less liquidity. And also, very importantly, there's going to be more sort of strict implementation of financial regulations. I think last year there was quite a bit of regulatory forbearance, as in everywhere else. I think this year they will reverse some of that. And China also, of course, rely quite a bit on these macroprudential rules, administrative rules to control credit growth itself, not just through rates and liquidity. So we're going to see that happening, and that's going to drive the overall credit growth slowing somewhat. But of course, most of the debt sort of stabilization is going to be done through a great recovery of growth.
Ginny, that debt pile in China has become pretty astronomical, hasn't it? By some measures, over 300% of GDP now. What are the dangers posed by such a high level of debt? And do you think policymakers are right to sort of refocus on reducing that level of debt at a time when the global economic recovery is still relatively uncertain?
There's huge concern about the growth of debt. But really, the makeup of that 300%, as you say, obviously there are lots of measurements. And also, as Tao hinted on, there's a lot of concern from regulators. We heard the top regulator really voicing his concerns about how a lot of that debt is going to create bubbles in the economy, particularly in the housing market. The makeup of it means that actually central government debt is not really the issue. As we know, it's more corporate debt. And that corporate debt is not your average, company debt, but actually it does include many aspects of the economy that are seeing, increasing risks of default. And we have seen more and more defaults, including a banking default. Very much picked up by the media there. So I think perhaps we're not going back to the era of deleveraging as such. As you say, we are still living with the pandemic struggles of trying to recover some of that growth momentum, but certainly assessing the current situation in terms of what are the most risky parts of those debts. So corporate debt, very much still a strong focus, and also to ensure that this debt pile doesn't impact on spending. And I think that is the key question. How do we continue to boost consumption while sorting out the problematic parts of that debt pile?
Absolutely. Tao, it's quite interesting, of course, that China's policymakers are lessening the stimulus somewhat at a time when, obviously, in America, we've just seen Joe Biden's administration pass a massive fiscal stimulus bill, $1.9 trillion. For investors and other observers, what do you see as the sort of result of that contrast, maybe in the policy stance in the world's two biggest economies?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think that the biggest difference, the biggest reason behind the difference of these policy divergence, I think, is really the timing of the recovery and the hit from the pandemic that are different, right? China was hit by the pandemic very hard in the first quarter of last year, but then after that, the activities normalized relatively quickly, the economy rebounded, and so last year, China is among the few that has had a positive economic growth, whereas the U.S., I think, it just saw a recession. The situation is still not quite under control, although there's some progress. So I think it's understandable that the U.S. Government still wants to be more supportive to the real economy, whereas China, as Ginny mentioned, is now shifting towards about controlling debt and controlling financial risk as the recovery continues. I think the market is very concerned that with a strong stimulus in the U.S. that is driving up the U.S. yields, government bond yields, and that could lead to capital flows to the emerging markets and to other countries change course, and that could drive up yields everywhere else as well. So there's a bit of concern that in China as well, as investors in China worry about imported inflation and that the tightening from the central bank of China may have to go further because of what's happening outside of China.
Yeah, Ginny, we've seen the stock markets in China falling quite sharply since Chinese New Year. Should we take that as a sign that investors are worried about the health of the economy in China, or do you think other factors are at play? And what's your general outlook for markets this year in China?
Well, I think it's important to stress that if you're just looking at the equity markets, it's still very much driven by domestic factors. And we have to obviously be very careful about which parts of the market we're talking about. Because as we know, for example, the fixed income, the bond market in China have seen inflows from foreign investors, in particular in Chinese government bonds and also policy bank bonds. So there's a lot of differentiation between the different asset classes. On the market itself, I think because China will remain one of the economies seeing the recovery really picking up momentum this year, and will still be benefiting from continued accommodative growth supportive policies. So we'll still see foreign investors being attracted to China's market, especially since there's still a lot of room for investment to come into the domestic market. We should be very focused on the fact that the capital market and China's equity market is still just opening up to foreign investors. So I think that should be the key. And also, the domestic worries about regulation may be short-term because there is a little bit of uncertainty at the beginning of the year as to exactly how much pressure there will be from a regulatory perspective to clamp down on the asset bubbles, on housing market. So we will get a clearer signal of that in the coming weeks.
Let's move on to more medium and long-term issues. As we've mentioned, the Communist Party has finalized its five-year plan for China, its 14th that it's undergone. The document sets out the country's policy priorities for this next coming period. This time, as you both mentioned, there's an emphasis on developing tech industries such as chip manufacturing, artificial intelligence, quantum computing. Tao, what's behind this push, would you say?
I think a very important background behind this is in the last couple of years, there has been rising pressures of decoupling from China, from outside, and also tech restrictions imposed by the US and that threatened to disrupt industries in China as well. So I think the government is concerned about technology and or supply chain security and safety. And they understand that actually, despite the rapid development in the past decades, China is still very much behind in many of these core technologies that is vital for development. And technology is also key to future growth and future sort of competitiveness. So I think for that purpose, for that reason, I think the authorities very much wants to increase the spending, increase the focus on technology, on innovation to catch up and to reduce that uncertainty and insecurity.
What's your feeling, Tao, on whether it's right really for this to come as a top-down program from the government? I mean, some observers would argue that these sorts of top-down plans are not the best way to develop high-tech industries. And of course, in recent years in China, we've seen massive tech companies like Alibaba and Tencent arise from the private sector. And so some people argue, why not just leave it to the more innovative private sector? Where do you stand on that debate?
I guess I stand somewhere in between. They are not mutually exclusive, these two kind of strategies. On one hand, I think to have a long-term vision and to guide policy incentives, guide market resources towards a vision, towards a goal, and mobilize resources and so on. I think it's helpful. We have seen success of industrial policies, not just in China's past, but in many other countries. The more sophisticated the economy becomes and the more important the private sector is, I think the more difficult to make such plans work. And innovation and technology, as you said, cannot easily be planned. The government can certainly devote more resources to it, but that does not guarantee innovation. So I think on one hand, I think they should emphasize the importance of it, but at the same time, it's not really about planning, it's about really have the right incentives and really help to release the energy and creativity of the private sector and the markets towards that goal.
Ginny, do you think the government in China is doing the right thing to encourage the development of the tech sector in the ways that they're planning?
Well, I think that Tao is absolutely right that there needs to be a vision. As we know, one of the benefits of having a long-term vision in China is that you can almost have more flexibility in the directions that markets take. So China, for the first time, unveiled this ambitious roadmap for a Vision 2035. And not just in technology, because obviously technology addresses the productivity shift that we know China needs to embark on. With the context of an aging population. That's why a lot of focus right now is about fertility, for example, and also increasing productivity. But on the other hand, we also need a vision in aspects such as, a sustainable and green-led growth recovery. And that also is where technology could feed into. So that vision, having a broader vision and being able to be more flexible within the sectors on how to drive that vision is hugely important. Obviously, there's no right or wrong, but clearly where China has the benefit is to have that longer-term planning so that corporates and sectors have some sort of certainty in terms of direction.
Tao, Beijing also in the last year has put forward the so-called dual circulation strategy. Often the Chinese government is not known for exciting names for its policies, but anyway, it's come up with this idea. Can you explain what dual circulation means, why it's so important to the government now, and what effect this might have on policy in the future?
Sure. I mean, dual circulation means both the internal domestic circulation and the integration with the rest of the world. I think the emphasis of the dual circulation, there's certainly an emphasis or increased emphasis on the domestic part of the equation. And that is a reflection of very challenging and changed external environment. The benign part is that China's economy has become bigger relative to the rest of the world. But another part is that the rest of the global environment has become a bit more less welcoming, and there's decoupling pressures and there are tech restrictions, as I mentioned. So I think that is the dual circulation strategy is a recognition of that reality. And then understanding that the future growth, much of the future growth has to come from within, and there's more growth potential to be unleashed, and there's more potential to have productivity gains there, and which actually means more domestic reforms. It's not just about supporting domestic consumption. It requires a lot of sort of supply side reforms that China has been talking about as well. And another part of this is if there's anything new to the dual circulation compared to all the policies we understood from before, is to build a more complete and secure supply chain that we talked about, the emphasis on technology, on innovation, to reduce that risk of disruption from external sources.
Yeah, a big part of the dual circulation, as you say, seems to be increasing China's ability to kind of rely on itself for growth and to also stimulate China's own consumer spending so that it relies less on the sort of big scale investment and exports for growth that we've seen in the past. But Ginny, Beijing, they've been talking about this shift to more domestic consumption and consumer spending for some years now. Do you think this time will be different? And if so, why and how?
Well, one of the things that we've seen last year in the recovery after the COVID crisis is that, in fact, what has been lagging is consumption growth. And that is a reality we have seen in data, although investment-led and manufacturing production growth, for example, have been relatively strong. We're still seeing that people are unwilling to spend because of the uncertainty. And as Tao mentioned, the dual circulation mentions the increasing uncertainties that externally, Chinese people are having to live with. And I think this is one of the key reasons why in the Lianghui, in the two sessions, what we've seen is a huge focus on poverty alleviation, addressing inequality, to ensure that, in fact, we can unleash even more consumption to make sure that not only the wealthy or those people in the city are able to spend, but in fact, people in rural sectors and also low-income groups are also more willing to spend. And of course, hand in hand, will be addressing some of those spending when it comes to, you know, healthcare and other welfare spending. So the confidence to spend is very key here. And I think last year was really an evidence to suggest that actually what's dragging growth behind really is the ability to unleash even more consumption and household consumption, not just, aggregate consumption, taking in account of government consumption.
But Ginny, did you see during the Lianghui any evidence that, you know, the government is trying to address some of the long-term issues that do get in the way of increased household consumption? For example, the Hukou system, the household registration system, which makes it difficult for many Chinese people who live in rural areas to move permanently to the cities. Did you feel that they address those kinds of long-term structural problems?
Well, Hukou itself, I didn't hear too much of emphasis on that, but probably because there are still local restrictions on mobility. So social mobility, for the time being, obviously, it is not, the core primary concern for the moment. But however, I think a key that we have heard through Lianghui is increased spending in healthcare, you know, in welfare systems. And that has been really been picked up. You know, in the Q&A or the press conference that Premier Li hosted, there was an explicit questioning about, healthcare and the vaccination, how people can better use the healthcare system and less of a burden, particularly for low-income groups and rural areas, to really make use of the existing welfare system, but for more reform in these social welfare systems.
Tao, what were your thoughts there on whether the government's doing enough to address these long-term issues to sort of shift the nature of growth in China?
I think from the market perspective, from the economist perspective, I think the progress has always been quite slow and a bit disappointing. But I also understand that these long-term structural changes are very challenging because they are quite political and there's politics everywhere. For example, Hukou system, there is a push to, you know, further liberalize Hukou in large cities of 3 million people and those kind of size. But I think the existing population in large cities are not welcoming more people to share their resources. So there's resistance there. And of course, local governments also care about who pays for those public services. Mm. So that involves the, you know, shift of resources from central to local governments, from certain parts of local government, certain regions to other regions. As you know, these kind of resource shift between regions and between different layers of government is always political everywhere. So I think one way the government is trying to bypass it, as Ginny mentioned, is reduce poverty, is to increase, enhance social safety net. And also, I think they are aiming to provide better and more equal public services in different types of cities, because in China right now, large cities have definitely much better public service than smaller cities, and then rural areas have very poor public services. This is an area I think that they can spend more on, and that can help.
Absolutely. Ginny, last question for you, just turning to the environment. Some commentators have expressed disappointment that China's leaders appear to water down some of their near-term environmental goals. Do you think that's a sign that government is finding it harder than expected to move away from polluting industries such as coal power generation as it tries to foster the economic recovery this year and in the next couple of years?
You're right in the sense that there has been a lot of coverage about the emphasis on the brown economy rather than, you know, trying to grow the green economy. But as I said, you know, a long-term plan and a vision is exactly how China is approaching this environmental issue. And if you've been listening to some of the coverage out of Beijing, everything has been around how to make this recovery a much greener one. So I think, you know, there is a lot of hope for a very drastic change in how China's banking, you know, credit lending and also capital markets is to support the exit of brown economy, rather than just neutralizing that with new sectors in renewable energy, electric vehicles, etc. But at the same time, I think, you know, the markets are aware that we do need to have some patience, but actually having ambition at all is very, very, very important. And also similar to the GDP target, you know, peaking carbon by 2030 and also carbon neutrality by 2060, these are achievable targets. They're not really, you know, ambitious targets as such. So I would expect to see much more clarity in the following week after the Lianhui. So I think that market coverage about not enough being done is a little bit harsh, because I think, as we all know, we don't expect clarity on implementation. We will see that in the follow-up discussions after these meetings.
Well, thank you, both of you, both Ginny and Tao, for all of those insights and for offering such a clear and insightful commentary on the big meetings that we've had in Beijing in the last week. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
We talked there about some of the longer term challenges facing China. And one of the major issues for the country is its worsening levels of wealth inequality and a widening gap between rural and urban areas in terms of prosperity, health, education, and other factors. Joining us now to discuss those issues further is Scott Rozell, whose recent book, Invisible China, is the result of decades of research into such matters. Scott is a senior fellow at the Freeman Spohley Institute for International Studies, and he holds a professorship at Stanford University. Scott also directs the Rural Education Action Plan, and he's a fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. Scott, thank you so much for joining us today, and welcome to Asia Matters.
Thank you so much, Andrew, and your whole staff. I'm looking forward to this.
Great. Well, your book is titled Invisible China, as I said. Can you explain the premise of the book and how you carried out your research?
So Invisible China is a pretty easy concept. It's rural China. And so these are the, 900 million, that's one out of nine people in the world live in rural China. And they're the workers that work in the factories, that the service people, the informal economy on the streets, women and children that are left behind in the villages, and the migrant families that are sort of up the alleys and in the basements. They're the workhorse on whose back China made this rise from poor to middle income. I've worked on China now for 40 years. When I first came was going to China, you know, it was everywhere. 85% of the people had a rural relative. Professors and government officials would go back every weekend to their homes. Today, on high-speed rails and planes, you just don't see it. And the news is full of Shenzhen, Beijing, Shanghai. And it's part of China now that really we just don't see, but is a huge issue that what's going to happen to rural China as China goes forward.
How has such a large wealth gap between China's urban and rural communities come about then?
There's a long history to it. It starts back in the planned economy when planning with Chinese characteristics, they basically had an urban industrial core of their economy that they planned and they put all the resources into, and the cities grew up, and the rural was sort of unplanned, and you know, they got grain from them and shipped them fertilizer, and the rest were on their own. Then when they turned into the reforms in the 80s, they gave out this hukou system. It's a residency permit. And the urban people got an urban hukou. The rural people got a rural hukou or residency permit. And everything was funded, their jobs, their homes, their infrastructure, and their social services, education, health, and early childhood development was funded locally. And the cities had a lot of money and a lot of fiscal resources, and economic activities in the rural areas didn't. And over the past 30 years, I mean, China has one of the highest inequality sort of measures of the world, and it's really split between rural and urban. That's what's driving those gaps.
And you talk now in your book about the potential for China to actually have some 200 to 300 million people who could become what you term structurally unemployed. Can you talk first about what you mean by that term and how this could now happen as China moves into its next stage of development?
When a country goes from poor to middle income, it drives that, and China has done it miraculously, it drives that growth by bringing rural people who are, you know, unskilled. But, you know, China did the right thing. They made them be numerate and literate and disciplined, and they made fantastic factory workers and construction workers. And, you know, that's what grew China up to the point that you get up to this, to the area that are like a middle income. They're now trying to make this push to high income. But China is now automating at an unbelievable rate. Globalization is moving supply chains, you know, out of China. China's trying to keep their own companies in China, but international companies are going to move as wages have risen. So high-income countries have most of the jobs in it are high-skill, high-wage jobs. And the question is, can these rural workers who, you know, were good at putting iPhones together and, you know, putting Christmas tree decorations together, can they now be in this high-tech economy? And the fact is, this rural economy that I've been talking about is in the labor force. A vast majority of them have never been to high school. And so they don't have the math, language, English, science, computer skills to participate in this new economy. And that's going to be the challenge, is can they rise and become employable in it? And if they can't, what are they going to do? Are they going to become structurally unemployed?
You talk in your book about how a lot of people who visit China are very impressed by the schools in the urban areas and the standard of education. But I guess the point you're making is that for the population at large, that level of education is simply not high enough for a higher skilled, a higher income economy.
Well, you know, if you know the United States system of education, right, we have 40,000 school districts that are funded by local taxes. And so if you live in Palo Alto, where I live, where Stanford University is, right, the property prices are high. There's lots of resources. We have phenomenal schools here. But if you go to poorer places where property prices are low, the school districts in those areas have very few resources. And so education is really poor. That's what's driving polarization in the U.S. That's exactly the same situation in China. The rural people live in rural counties. They have almost no fiscal resources. How do you fund schools to go? And here's the other thing is these local governments have lots of different fiscal responsibilities and demands on those funds. Do I invest in my small little county seats and build them up? Or do I invest in rural schools? When they send a rural kid in their county to high school, and they go to high school and they go to college, guess what? Those kids never come back to that rural county. And so there's no incentive to invest in those. That's what's happening. So China has a lower level. China's labor force has a lower level of education in the OECD terms of the share of kids that have been to high school than South Africa. It's lower than Turkey. It's lower than Mexico. They have one of the lowest educated populations in the whole world. Now, there's a lot of really smart kids in these urban areas that have gone to these very good colleges, but overall, these 800 million people in the labor force, 70% of them have never spent one day in high school.
Why is it then that those sort of smart kids, the people driving the higher end of the economy, why don't you think that will be enough? Can't China sort of rely on those people and then sort of redistribute the wealth, spread the wealth around a bit to fund the rest of the population?
Nobody's ever made it work.
Right.
You know, the only countries in the world over the past, 70 years that have been able to go from middle income to high income have been those countries where almost 70 or 80% of the people in that labor force have been educated to a high school level or higher. You know, that gives you the skills to learn how to learn these new jobs. Can they do it? They're going to have to start spending an enormous amount of money to put that safety net under the rural people who are going to become unemployed as manufacturing jobs fall to automation, as supply chains, upgrade and move out of the country. If they can retrain these workers, and it's hard to retrain workers that have never been to high school, right? I mean, how do they even sit down and study to learn a new job? And can they provide the safety net? You know, can they get kids who are in school now all up to the high school level? That these are big, big choices, very expensive. And China has, a lot of things on their plate.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're funding military, they're funding, international aid. They're funding the rest of their country. If you look at the current plans that are going forward and the discussions in this in the two-party Congress that's going on now, you don't see this commitment to the rural economy. They're doing stuff. They're doing things. But I don't think it's enough.
I should say that you're very much at pains in the book to make it clear that you're not a China basher at all by any means. You want to see China succeed just from a human point of view, as I'm sure many of us do. What do you see as the main risks from having so many people in an economy with insufficient skills to fully take part in that economy?
Yes, no, that's a great question. I think there's two things to really think about. Is first of all, when China has figured out that there's a real problem, that they've always take pains to go after it. Right? And sometimes they do it right, sometimes they don't, but they really do focus and are able to generate solutions, right? The second thing is, this is a problem that's invisible in so many ways. It hasn't been a problem in the past. This uneducated rural labor force, has been one of the drivers of growth. Right? And I just don't think that, they're looking forward enough. And many countries have had the same problem. When I was in grad school in the 1980s, we thought Mexico was going to be, it was called the next Taiwan, right? Mm. And it was admitted to OECD, right? The rich man's club. They had made it, right? And look what happened to Mexico, right? There was some globalization, right? What happened? The maquiladoras all went over to China, right? In the early 90s. And there was a huge unemployment, 10 million people, 20% of the labor force was laid off in Mexico. They went to the United States, and then they went into the informal economy, and they went into organized crime. And Mexico has not grown since the mid-1990s, basically, right? And those are the types of things that could happen to China. Chinese rural people right now are working very hard. They've benefited for 30 years. But the younger people start saying, what's my future, right? Am I going to have a job? Am I going to have a job 5 years from now or 10 years from now? Or is that job going to have any benefits? Then they're going to start making this decision. Should I stay within the system or should I go outside the system? And, going outside the system is expensive, but they're going to do it, if it's better for them. The legitimacy of China's government is to give its people all a rising level of standard of living. And if that starts to slow down, if that goes away, if the Chinese dream, right, starts to go away, you could see a lot of people getting hurt. And when that starts to get hurt, how does that then flop over to the rest of the world and to Asia? So, you know, I'm not a political scientist, so, you know, I could see lots of really negative things happening around Asia because of that, as legitimacy tries to be, you know, got back. But, you know, I think that that's the real problem right there. And, you know, so I don't want to, we don't want to see it happen.
Scott, thank you so much for talking us through this. I do urge all of our listeners to take a look at the book. It contains some pretty eye-opening stuff about how China's education and health system works and some of the longer-term problems that the country faces. Thank you again for joining us and for talking us through that.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Well, thank you to all our guests, Scott Rozelle, Tao Wang, and Ginny Yan, for those insights into China's big economic challenges. You can find out more at our website, asiamatterspod.com, where you can get in touch with us as well. And you can also follow us on Twitter with the handle @AsiaMattersPod. Thank you to my colleagues and producers on this episode, Aaron Safir and Carl Sirota. And thank you also to Alexander Lestrange for the title music for Asia Matters. I hope you'll join us for more editions in future. But for now, goodbye.